Throughout the 4 long months of the Eichmann trial, one question recurred again and again. How could 6 million people have gone to their deaths with so little outward resistance? There were many explanations.
Back in Warsaw, had you heard about Treblinka?
We'd heard about Treblinka.
You knew Jews were being exterminated there?
We did not believe it.
You did not believe it? Why not?
One just could not grasp that this was at all possible. Simply extermination.
One time a mother came out with her child, and when she undressed, she spit in the face of this SD man. They took the child on the legs, knocked the head against a tree, and put it into fire, and her they hanged on her feet. The other women, seeing this, said themselves, what for? And this happened quite a few times.
We were helpless. Our morale was completely broken. They had prepared us for months on end so that on hearing their very voices, we began shaking and trembling. It was a veritable collective psychosis which one could not overcome. Inside the car, we all crowded together, and there were Ukrainians in front of the wagons, and they laughed and said, now we'll have lots of soap, you're all going to be made into goulash.
Here in the air of this courtroom, there hovers the question, why did the people not rise? But, Your Honor, in order to fight under any conditions, and all the more so under the conditions of the ghetto, you need first of all a fighters' organization. And an organization of fighters can be set up by an order issuing from the national authority or by the strength of an internal movement. The Jews of Europe were not called upon or could not be called upon by any national authority. Well, only people with a strong will can set up such an organization. And people of strong will are not generally to be found among the desperate and the broken and the downtrodden. They were broken and downcast and in despair. I have seen desperate people commit suicide, but I have not seen people overtaken by despair become good fighters.
But there were those who did resist, even in the death camps themselves. There was the revolt of the doomed prisoners at Sobibor.
I was working with another friend called David. We removed all the tools from the warehouse and put two boys with axes into each workshop. Untersturmführer Neumann was the first to come in. The man entered the carpentry shop and never came out again. He was commander of the camp at the time. He was killed in the carpentry shop. I saw an SS man go into the Ukrainian shoemaker's workshop, and he was killed there. Later, a Ukrainian arrived on a bicycle. He too was killed at the shoemaker's shop. 13 Germans were killed in this way, and a number of Ukrainians. Altogether, some 18 were killed.
And there were those who escaped the ghettos to fight as partisans in the forests.
In the forest, I found remnants of Jewish townships. We set up a Jewish fighting unit. We set up family camps of the Jews who were there, to whom we extended protection. I estimate there were in the forest about 15,000 Jewish partisans. And I can say that it is not only we who gave them something, but they gave us quite a lot in return. When we came to them, we saw Jewish fathers. We saw Jewish mothers. We saw Jewish children. Figures that had long since disappeared from our lives and our horizons in the forest. The feeling of being in a Jewish home was restored to us when we came into contact with those family camps, notwithstanding the fact that we were the patrons, we protected them, and we fed them.
And of course, there was the revolt of the Warsaw Ghetto.
I saw thousands of Germans surrounding the ghetto with machine guns and cannon, while we, a handful of 20 young men and women, were facing them. What were our weapons at the time? We each had one revolver and one hand grenade. The whole group had two guns amongst them. And we had a few very primitive homemade bombs. It was a strange sight. The 20 Jewish men and women standing joyfully up against a powerful enemy, armed to their teeth. Why were we so gay and cheerful? Because we were confident that their end would come. We knew that at first they would be the victors, but we had no doubt that they would pay a high price for our lives.
For all the glory with which the fighters covered themselves, their battle was a hopeless one. Eichmann's net was spread too wide. His zeal and his resources were too great. Rudolf Hess best described Eichmann's motivations.
Eichmann was all wrapped up in his task and convinced that this extermination was necessary to protect the German nation in the future from the Jewish will to exterminate it. This is how he saw his task, and he strove with might and main to implement the extermination program as planned by the Reichsführer SS. Eichmann violently opposed any exemption of able-bodied Jews. He saw in this a constant danger to the final solution through mass escapes and other incidents which might occur. In his opinion, things were to be done with utmost speed and in a decisive manner, so that all necessary steps should be taken against all the Jews on whom they could possibly lay their hands, because one could never know how the war would end.
In every country in Europe, Eichmann and his agents operated. But in only one, Denmark, was the population able to band together to rescue its Jewish fellow citizens and to foil the final solution. Everywhere else, the story was the same. A Dutch Jewess, shunted from one concentration camp to another, was interviewed by Eichmann in 1945.
We knew who was Eichmann in Holland. He was notorious for using Jewish expressions, and we believed there was a story that he knows Hebrew perfectly, that he was born in Palestine. But the main purpose of this interview was to find out what we knew about extermination camps, and whether in Ravensbrück we contacted people who were taken to Auschwitz and who came from Theresienstadt. We were told that we would be given the privilege to enter the Theresienstadt ghetto, but if we would speak of our experiences in Ravensbrück, he used a very special expression, "You will be put through the chimneys."
And a Hungarian Jew watched him operate in Budapest.
They toasted each other in brandy to celebrate the fact that the government of Hungary had consented to the deportations. That had not been an easy thing to obtain. Then they discussed how the plan was to be implemented. Wislicheni suggested, a train be sent every third day. That means a train of 3,000 to 3,200 people. Eichmann said that this was not enough, and that is how they were sent, 12,000 Jews a day.
It was an overwhelming picture that the prosecution drew of the life work of Adolf Eichmann, but then there came the turn of the defense, and Dr. Savatius began his presentation.
Your Honors, President and members of the Court, two worlds oppose each other in these proceedings. The world of those who suffer and the world of those who rule. the victims and the machine of dictatorship. One world is down below, and the other up on high, and the world of the Caesars knows no tears. The defense will show that the accused was inexorably and unavoidably involved in the persecution of the Jews as a result of political directives issued by those at the helm of the state.
Eichmann took the stand in his own defense. He explained his role as the expediter of Jewish emigration from Germany and Austria.
I had orders from my superiors to do all I could to promote immigration, even forcibly if that was necessary. The Zionism and the various countries advocated emigration to Palestine, and I think that none of the Zionist functionaries of that time could come and claim that I had hamstrung his work. On the contrary, I think they would have to come and testify that I helped their work along and promoted it.
He explained, too, that he was not responsible for the final solution as drawn up at the Wannsee Conference.
And here I found for myself a certain source of tranquility, considering the fact that in spite of my relatively low rank of lieutenant colonel or even lower shortly before, I had off my own bat sought solutions which were not impossible, which were acceptable to both sides, but never such forcible or bloody solutions. And after I was able thus, so to speak, to clear in my mind what my own desire had been in the light of the result of the Wannsee Conference, at that moment I could feel a certain contentment of the kind which Pontius Pilate may have felt, because I felt that no guilt attached to me. Here at the Wannsee Conference, the men at the top of the then Reich were having their say. The popes were issuing their orders. I had to obey. That is what I thought of in the course of all the years.
He described himself as a dispatcher of trains whose cargoes were not his responsibility.
I know that what I said sounds unbelievable, but the documents prove that even in preparing and drawing up timetables, I was only a marginal figure here, since in Hungary these matters were arranged by my superiors in person, by Winkelmann and Wesenmeyer. So that, in fact, I had to do no more than that in this specific context. That's how it is. I know this is unbelievable or hard to believe, but it emerges from the documents that I am right.
There was also an explanation for the Jews for Trucks deal that Eichmann offered Joel Brand.
Eines Tages kam Joel Brand.
One day, Joel Brand came to my office. Meanwhile, I had raised the figure of 100,000 or 200,000, which had just been a figure to operate with in making first soundings. I had raised it to 1 million, for psychological reasons, so to speak, in order to be able to approach my superiors without standing the risk of immediately being ordered to leave the room. Because had I come with reasons of mercy or with small numbers, 5,000 or 10,000, Müller would not have listened to me. But this matter of 1 million, that was a new thing. That was too high even for Müller to reject off his own bat. And the outcome was completely unexpected. I could myself hardly believe my ears when it was reported to me that the program had been approved. What I can only say is that I was doing my level best in order to facilitate Brand's activities, and I did my utmost to help him, because all that went, if I may say so, to boost my own credit.
But invariably, despite the mountain of evidence to the contrary, Eichmann described himself as a clerk, as a man who carried out orders given by his superiors and who never acted for himself. Every order was countersigned, every command accounted for as originating from a higher source, every step, some taken under protest, done at the behest of others. His visits to concentration camps, described in detail by witnesses and in statements from his subordinates, were explained by Eichmann in this manner.
The second journey was not carried out on the basis of orders given to me by Heydrich, but by Müller. He told me I was to go to the Wartegau, to a place which I understand was called Kulm or Kulmhof, that Jews were there being exterminated by means of gas. Müller wanted a report on the way in which the Jews were being exterminated there. That was after I had reported to Müller the first time. I had requested him and asked to be detailed to another sort of work because I was not the man suited for this particular kind of activity. And I remember Müller then answered and said that the soldier at the front too couldn't possibly pick and choose the post to which he was detailed. These were the service journeys as ordered, and I was merely sent with a view to collecting information and reporting on what was going on, reporting to Müller, at whose behest I went on those trips, and the first time to Heydrich. But on none of these journeys did I have any other functions or mission. I was not to give any advice or tips to the men on the spot. I had merely to see things, to act as an observer, and to report to my superiors without commentary.
The defense rested its case, and the prosecution began its cross-examination of the defendant. Hausner was relentless in his attempts to break down Eichmann's description of himself as a filing clerk, a transportation officer. Boring in again and again, he pounded away with arguments which contradicted the defendant's story, making extensive use of documents, orders signed by Eichmann, communications sent to him, official files of the Gestapo and the German Foreign Office, and reports by those who watched him at his labors. This was a typical exchange between Hausner and Eichmann.
How often did you go to Auschwitz?
I have tried to count the number of times.
How many times were you in Auschwitz?
And have come to the conclusion that it was 4 or 5 times.
And you spoke with Hess?
Yes, I spoke with Hess, yes.
And then he visited you in Budapest?
Yes, he was also in Budapest, but as far as I remember,
in order to establish the reception capacity of Auschwitz for the Jews of Hungary, correct?
Hess negotiated in Budapest in the first place, not with me, but with Winkelmann.
What did he speak to you about?
Of course, this too must have been on the same subject.
Then say so. What are you beating about the bush for? Why don't you come out straight and say so?
I'm not beating about the bush, but in Hungary too, I was only at the receiving end of orders and not giving orders. First he had to refer to those who were giving orders, then to the one who was being given his orders.
And Hess complained that he did not have room enough in Auschwitz for all the deportees from Hungary whom it was intended to deport to Auschwitz. Isn't that so?
It is possible. I do not at all deny this, but it was not within my competence.
But it was you that he negotiated with about Auschwitz and its reception capacity in particular. And you wanted to send more trains, and he wanted to receive fewer trains. This argument was carried on with you and with no one else.
Neither was I the man who asked for more trains or he for less trains. He certainly discussed the matter, but here again, I was not authorized to decide the speed and the pace of the transport. These were at the discretion of my superiors and not at my discretion. This is evident from the documents.
Then why did he come and speak to you in Budapest? Did he come for a cup of coffee?
Certainly not. I was one of those whom he had to approach, because in matters of detail, I could give more precise information than my superiors could.
We were speaking about directives concerning deportations to Auschwitz, but you yourself said there were instructions for other kinds of deportations, correct?
Yes, jawohl.
Jawohl is enough for me. That's quite enough. These were transports sent not to Auschwitz, but straight to the death camps.
I do not at all intend to deny this, because I did not give the orders.
So when you issued over your own signature directives such as in prosecution document 1339, these are directives for the deportation of Jews to Ispica near Lublin, because these people are being sent straight to extermination, correct?
The contents of this signal are correct.
I'm not asking you if the contents are correct, but whether these Jews were destined for extermination, yes or no?
Yes, this may be correct. I do not deny
this. No, you don't deny this? Then say yes.
This was by order.
Oh, it was by order.
It was always by order. On that excuse, Eichmann constructed his entire defense. But of responsibility for his actions, one heard nothing from the defendant. He lived in a world in which moral precepts played no part. It was this that made possible the question he asked of Dean Gruber one day in Berlin, near the start of his career. How different that career might have been had he listened to Dean Gruber's reply.
Kam eines Abends hier abgekämpft in die Kurfürstenstraße.
One evening, I arrived very tired at the office in Kurfürstenstrasse. He said, "Why do you bother at all about the Jews? No one will thank you for what you are doing." I answered him, because I thought that here was a man who once belonged to the Templar's order and as such knew Palestine. I said, "Do you know the road leading from Jerusalem to Jericho?" And he nodded. And I said, "On this road there once lay a Jew who had fallen among thieves. And a non-Jew passed by and helped him. And the one and only master whom I serve now bids me, go thou and do likewise."